Have you ever looked back at your life and where you are right now? And you've looked back and you've seen that some things happened to you where man meant evil against you. In other words, someone tried to hurt you or did hurt you. They tried to intentionally limit you, or maybe they just wanted to cut you down, or they said something about you, or physically hurt you, or did something in some way to... It wasn't just that events happened and you made a choice to leave and go somewhere. It's that someone actually hurt you. Someone caused it to happen. Famously in the Bible, you look back, and to me, I always think of that. I think of Joseph, where that verse is actually found, where Joseph is this the son of, among all of his other brothers, he was the favorite. And if there's any question, his dad even gave him a special uniform that signified how special he was. He gave him what the Bible calls a coat of many colors. So this was a multicolored coat. At that time in the Middle East, I mean, at that time, it was not easy. It's not like he went to Brooks Brothers. It's not like he went to Gap or Old Navy or whatever it was and just was like, oh, hey, they got coats of many colors are half off this week, so I'm going to grab one of those for my son. This was something that would have had to be handmade, imported fabric, silks from Egypt, very expensive, probably some Egyptian cotton, which is still a thing. You know, fancy pants sheets, you know, with the Egyptian cotton, I don't know, thread counts, I'm not sure. I don't think we've ever really paid attention to that, babe, have we? No, okay. Whatever Bed Bath & Beyond has provided us is plenty, so that's good. And so he's got this coat of many colors, and if you've ever lived in a family, and this breaks my heart because we try so hard with our girls to make sure that there isn't one that seems to be loved more. You know what I mean? Like, we love them equally. We don't, that thought doesn't even exist. But maybe some of you have a past where that did happen, and there was a favorite child, and there was special attention paid to them, and they didn't wear the coat of many colors, but they did in a kind of a symbolic, figurative way. And so you can understand the brothers' anger with Joseph. You can understand why they just did not like him at all, because he doesn't help matters. If you read the biblical account in Genesis about how Joseph was, you know, here he is, this already the favorite son, already super bright, smart, just a great kid. But he has a dream, and he tells all his brothers the dream. And in the dream, basically he tells his brothers, you know what, someday, even though I'm the youngest, even though I'm, you know, he has one more younger brother, but at this point, he was at least second youngest, and he had all these other ones, 10 older brothers at that point. In this culture, if you were the youngest, that wasn't like a cute, spoiled situation like it is now, where if you're the baby of the family, it's like sort of the parents have run out of energy, and they're just like, whatever Cliff wants, just, we don't, you know, the first two just exhausted us, he's okay. You know, which is funny, because Angie and I are both babies of the family. So she was the youngest of four, I was the youngest of three, and so it's been an interesting thing, because we're both just used to getting whatever we want. No, I'm just kidding. It's not true. Just her. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So here Joseph walks up to his brothers and says something very explosive in the sense, he says, hey, someday I had this dream, and someday you're going to be bowing down to me. You're going to be serving me. And that just didn't happen. That's not how it worked. So they didn't like him at all. They just were so upset at him. And these brothers were not to be messed with. I mean, these were not just like the kind of older brothers that would just give you, you know, noogies and, you know, just throw you on the ground and kind of beat you up in front of their friends and kind of just teach you a lesson as a younger brother. These were the older brothers that, like, literally killed 300 people in a village at Shechem because of something that had happened to their sister. Their sister had been raped there, and they went and befriended this whole village, and then they butchered them. These are not the kind of brothers that you just kind of want to have picking on you. They were at a whole different class. And so in the story of Joseph, his father draws him in and says, hey, will you go and check on your brothers? Because they were hanging out near that same village of Shechem where they had butchered so many. And his dad's thinking, I don't want them to start another war. So Joseph goes this long distance, and as he comes up over the hill, guess what he's wearing on his long journey? His fancy pants coat. And they see him from a distance, and they just have had enough. They're like, oh, here comes that dreamer. Here comes that punk. I just want to smash him. That's a different translation says that. And so they're like, let's kill him. I mean, it's a little intense. And they're talked out of killing him, but boy, they beat him up and they throw him in a hole and they take his beloved coat. And you can just imagine them all taking that coat and yanking it apart and just throwing it on the ground, be like, his darn coat, taking out all of their hurt and anger on their brother for the failure of their father. And so to be compassionate to Joseph, instead of killing him, they say, you know what, I have an idea. Let's just sell him into slavery for the rest of his life. And that seemed like a good idea to all of them. So they sell him into slavery and he's taken to Egypt. And then they take his coat and they dip it in blood and they bring it to the father and lie to their dad and say he was torn to pieces. And the dad's heartbroken. Joseph then goes and God's hand was on his life and he goes to Egypt and he serves under Potiphar. So here, you think about evil. My goodness, his brothers wanted to kill him. They sold him into slavery. I pray that your story doesn't even come close to that tragedy and that wounding and that abuse. But Potiphar purchases him and puts him in charge. First, he's just a slave in his house, and he sees God's hand is on him, and he's so bright, and everything he does turns to gold. He says, you know what? You're in charge of everything in my house. The only thing that you're not in charge of is my wife. Unfortunately, she wanted him to be in charge of her. And so she came to him and threw herself at him, and he ran out. And unfortunately, again, here's another situation. The coat he was wearing, not the coat of a beloved son, now he's wearing the cloak of a slave. She grabs the cloak, and he runs off, and he just needed to get out of the house. So she's holding his cloak. And other servants may have seen him running out, wearing either his underwear or absolutely nothing. And she holds on to that cloak as evidence, tells her husband another lie about Joseph involving his cloak, his coat. She says, he tried to rape me. So he's thrown into prison as a rapist. I mean, when I think of Joseph's story now, it is like this one of the scariest stories in the Bible. He did nothing wrong at this point. Now he's serving a hard time as a slave who's been accused of raping his master's wife in an Egyptian prison. This is not a good story to this point. But while he's down there, guess what happens? God's hand's on his life, and the warden sees him, and he puts him in charge of the whole prison. Everything is under his control except for the warden. So some guys start having dreams down there, and Joseph interprets their dreams. And one of them is restored to the king's service. And Joseph is still in prison for years. He's in prison for something he didn't do. The stigma of being a sexual deviant is upon him and a slave. And then Pharaoh has a dream and nobody can interpret it. Nobody can interpret it. And finally, one of the man who was restored to his position remembers Joseph and says, wait, there was a slave, a Hebrew slave, in jail with me who interpreted my dream. We're so desperate. What do you think? And the Pharaoh says, bring him up here. And so he comes up. And of course, Joseph immediately interprets the dream, gives credit to God. And Pharaoh is so impressed, so moved by his wisdom and by just his demeanor and the hand of God that he sees clearly on him, that he makes him in charge of everything in the entire kingdom except for himself and his family. This is unheard of. And part of what Joseph interpreted was that there was a famine coming and they needed to save their food to prepare for it. I look at the story of Joseph and I am so grateful to God that that is not my story. That is a heartbreaking, hard story. Think about how he felt his dad and how his dad really set him up to fail and how his father was not a good father and his brothers just wanted to kill him and sold into slavery and now he's in prison. I mean, all these elements. I'm like, God, why did you allow all of this to happen? And then Joseph puts the verse on and says, what man has meant for evil, God has meant for good. Because now Joseph is second in command over the most powerful empire of the world at that time, Egypt. And before that, he was just the second to last born of a family of shepherds in the Middle East. He wouldn't have had Pharaoh's ear. He wouldn't have had any influence at all. He wouldn't have been there to help save his people from starvation. It's amazing if you look back at your life and you see the events that took place to get you to your seat this morning, to this pew, this room, this date in the summer of 2015. Isn't it amazing to look back that sometimes God uses really positive things to move us along? A great conversation, a great job, a great relationship, great parents, great spouse, great friends, great neighbors, great bosses. Sometimes that's how it works. But how often is it a different story? How often is it that you are sitting here today because of a horrible spouse? How many of you are sitting here today because of terrible parents or bad, broken family situation, or you have nowhere to go because of a bad situation at a job or with a family? But you're here. What I love is that what man means for evil, God can turn into good. And at the end of that verse, Joseph says, what man meant for evil, God meant for good, the saving of many lives. Isn't it powerful to think that in Joseph's story, it was even a shadow of the cross there? That what man meant for evil, there, could you think of a more evil moment than taking an innocent man who did nothing, heaping all of this, these lies and accusations on him that he did, and Jesus saying nothing as he stood there and took it all. He took the beating, he took the abuse, he took every bit of it, and then he died on the cross innocent of anything. All the evil of the people who were there and all of the wrath of God towards the evil of all mankind, all of it is poured out on the innocent one. Because what man was meaning for evil in that moment, wiping him out, God meant for good, the saving of many lives. Through the death of Jesus Christ, I'm alive. Through the death of Jesus Christ, maybe you're alive and free today. It's an extravagant introduction to where we're going today, because we are in the book of Acts, chapter 23. And I wanted to start there because last week, if you want to turn your Bibles to Acts chapter 23, verse 12, last week we really focused on Acts chapter 23, verse 11, where Paul is sitting in the dungeon. He's sitting in a Roman jail. He's discouraged. He's bleeding. He's broken. He's bruised. He's confused. He's scared. He's sitting there wondering, God, why in the world did this happen? You told me I was going to Jerusalem, and I knew I was going to suffer, but I have barely been able to talk. And Jesus appears to him and says, take courage, for as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome. Now, what's amazing about that is, how is Paul supposed to get to Rome in this moment? He is the most wanted man in the city of Jerusalem. Anytime he walks outside and says a word, the crowds are literally trying to yank his arms and legs off of his body. I mean, so is the violent hatred of him right now. He's got to somehow get from the middle of a jail cell surrounded by, and remember, this is around Pentecost, surrounded by 250,000 to 1 million people who have been turned against him, who want him dead. He's got to get from there all the way to Rome. How's that going to happen? Watch what God does to get Paul on his way to the purpose for the rest of his life. Look at verse 12. When it was day, the Jews made a plot and bound themselves by an oath neither to eat or drink until they had killed Paul. There were more than 40 who made this conspiracy. They went to the chief priests and elders and said, we have strictly bound ourselves by an oath to taste no food till we have killed Paul. Now, therefore, you, along with the council, give notice to the tribune to bring him down to you as though you were going to determine his case more exactly. And we are ready to kill him before he comes near. Okay, so let's pause right there. So in the moments that Jesus is appearing to Paul and encouraging him and saying, take courage, at that same moment, this plot is being hatched. This plot, this plan, this scheme, this murderous assassination attempt is being planned. This is the next morning. They found 40 men. 40 men said, we have bound ourselves by an oath. We're not going to eat. We're not going to sleep. We're going to allow a dog to bark outside. I don't know if you heard that. Oh, I don't know. Might be a coyote. That would be interesting, wouldn't it? Sounds like it. They followed me. I knew they were on my trail. So these 40 men bound themselves by an oath. They weren't going to eat or drink until he's dead. That's serious. I don't know how long you can go without eating. But eating and drinking, some of you are already like, man, finish up so I can go eat because I'm really getting hungry thinking about it. I mean, this is a serious, oh, this is not like, I will not jog again, or I will not watch television again until this is done, or I promise you I will not mow my lawn again until this is, you know, all those things you can go days or weeks or even longer living without. But man, eating or drinking, that's pretty basic needs. We're not going to eat or drink. This is a serious, and there's 40 of them. 40. That's quite a pack. You look at the context here and you look at who was around, there probably were zealots in this group. Because this is how a zealot thought. A zealot thought, let's kill the infidel. Let's get rid of this guy to purify our nation. So 40 zealots bound themselves together. But here's what's interesting. The zealots hated the Sadducees. Hated them. That was one of their primary targets when they would assassinate people, were the Sadducees. So here they are. Look at verse 14. It says that this group went to the chief priests and elders and said, we have strictly bound ourselves by an oath. Now, therefore, you, along with the council, give notice to the tribune to bring him down to you as though you're going to determine his case more exactly and ready to kill him. So basically, here are the zealots. There's 40 of them. They're like bound by an oath. We're not going to eat or drink until Paul is dead. And they go and they tell their hated chief priest, who was a Sadducee. This is how much they hated Paul. They're all working together. There was an interesting line in the crucifixion account that talked about the relationship between Pontius Pilate and King Herod. Two men that really, Pontius Pilate would not have liked Herod. He was stuck in this area, stuck in Jerusalem. He did not like his assignment. History tells us Pontius Pilate was a pretty nasty guy in general. His moment of seeming compassion sort of was an aberration from his character. And you've got King Herod, a Sadducee, just completely slippery, the worst politician ever, just will lie and do whatever. So these two would have been natural enemies. And there's a line in one of the crucifixion accounts that says, after Jesus left King Herod and King Herod and Pontius Pilate talked, and Herod says, I don't find anything wrong with them. It says that they became friends that day. That day they became friends from that day forward. Isn't it interesting how when there is evil plan for someone who's innocent, when there is something, when there is an enemy plan, where there's clearly spiritual warfare at play, that even the enemies, there's a line that says, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. That even enemies can come together to accomplish something. So you've got Sadducees and zealots hated each other. Sadducees were afraid of the zealots. Zealots kept trying to kill Sadducees. It makes sense. But here they're like, let's set aside our petty differences. I'm sure when they were going to see the chief priest, they're like, okay, you 40 guys, let's search them for weapons, okay? Get them out of here. Check them. Make sure. Do the wand to the airport thing. Okay, they're clean. Come on in. What do you need? What do you need, guys? I mean, 40 zealot assassins? That's pretty scary. But they're working together. Because they hated Paul so much that even long rivals that hate each other set down their grievances and bound themselves together to murder Paul. And this plan is awful. In fact, they have to have cooperation of the Sanhedrin here as well. Now, you know it says they told some of the council because they're not going to tell the Pharisees, right? Remember what just happened last week? The Pharisees stood up and defended Paul. Like, wait a minute, this guy's not that bad. I think we should just leave him alone. And the big fight broke out. So they're not going to tell the Pharisees they're ready to kill this guy. But the Sadducees were in on it because they were already really upset at Paul. And the Zealots are in on it because they really are upset at Paul. And here's their plan. Call for him. In other words, say, hey, we need to examine him again at the Sanhedrin. I need to clarify the charges. And when he's on his way, we're going to kill him. Now think about the zealot agenda here. Who is going to be guarding Paul at that moment that he's being transported from the barracks to the Sanhedrin? Roman soldiers, a lot of them, right? What happens to a Roman soldier if something bad happens to their prisoner? They face the same fate because they wanted to keep corruption out of the Roman Empire as best they could. So here was a man who was not only under their protection, but a Roman citizen. So they are going to protect him. So by the zealots saying, by this group of 40 saying, we're going to kill him, they're saying we are going to attack Paul, try and kill Paul. And if we kill some Romans while we do it, no problem. This is going to start a war in Jerusalem. And that's what the zealots have always wanted. So this is their plan. Now listen to what happens. Verse 16. Now the son of Paul's sister, so Paul's nephew, heard of their ambush. So he went and entered the barracks. And told Paul, Paul called one of the centurions and said, take this young man to the tribune, for he has something to tell him. So he took him and brought him to the tribune. This is Claudius Lysias, the man in charge of 1,000 soldiers. And he said, Paul, the prisoner, called me and asked me to bring this young man to you, as he has something to say to you. The tribune took him by the hand and, going aside, asked him privately, what is it that you have to tell me? And he said, the Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down to the council tomorrow, as though they were going to inquire somewhat closely about him. But do not be persuaded by them, for more than 40 of their men are lying in ambush for him, who have bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they have killed him. And now they are ready, waiting for your consent. So the tribune dismissed the young man, charging him, tell no one you've informed me of these things. Okay, a couple interesting things. This is the first mention of Paul's extended family at all. We know he's from Tarsus. We know that he is a tent maker, which makes us believe that his parents were tent makers. That's really all we know. We know his family was committed to their son serving God with his life because they put him through the rabbinic system, which would mean that from the age of 15 to 30, he would have been sitting at the feet of Gamaliel. So the parents, you know just from that passage, are devout, they are committed, and they are absolutely 100% on board with Paul's career. But he's got a sister who lives in Jerusalem, or at least was in town, and the sister has a son. And the son, this nephew, and the passage keeps calling him a young man, but everything about the passage here suggests he's a boy. Because if he was a man, they would never let him run into a Roman barracks right past all the soldiers and get to the most wanted man in Jerusalem. They would never let that happen. There's no way they would all stand and be like, what are you doing? Get out of here. You can't come in. Check him for weapons. What are you doing? What do you need? What do you need? Instead, they let this, but a little boy can kind of work right in there. And people are like, oh, just let him go. It's a kid. Oh, it's his nephew. Just let him go. It's fine. He's a little boy. Go for it. He gets to Paul, tells him what's going on. And Paul says, just go tell Claudius Lysias. And even the words here of how Claudius Lysias, this commander of 1,000, how he deals with this boy, says he took him by the hand and, going aside, asked him privately, almost like, okay, buddy, what is it? What do you need, pal? You don't do that with a man. You don't take him by the hand and lead him aside and scrunch down and ask him what he's doing and what's going on. I mean, this is clearly a young man, a young boy. So he had heard of the plans, and he tells him what's up. And the Roman leader here, Claudius Lysias, says, don't tell anyone that you've informed me of these things. So then, verse 23, he called two of the centurions and said, get ready 200 soldiers and 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen to go as far as Caesarea at the third hour of the night. Also provide mounts for Paul to ride and bring him safely to Felix, the governor. Okay, so was anyone adding that up as we went through how much protection he had? 470 armed Roman soldiers were going to transport one prisoner from here to Caesarea, 60 miles or so. That's insane. 470 armed Roman soldiers, horses, spearmen, soldiers, swords drawn, spears out, horses around him. And they said, ready a mount for Paul. So he's laid on top of a horse while they are walking him out of town. He got an armed escort out of town by the most powerful army in the world, one of the most powerful armies in the history of civilization. 470. This is more than the president gets. This is insane. This is like, you ever get caught behind a presidential motorcade or be around it or anything? We were at the end of a very long trip not too long ago, and we pulled off the turnpike right at the, what's that exit, baby? Weedsport. And we're like, yes. For us, it's like, oh, man, we are almost home. It's like, you see that exit? Now it's just back roads, and we're almost there. But we had to put, everyone's like, pull over, pull off. We had to sit there for an hour and 20 minutes because the presidential bus motorcade was rolling through. He had a speaking engagement in Auburn a couple years ago. And we had to sit there with our kids who were ready to be home in every possible way. An hour and 20 minutes, I believe. And just so that he can kind of roll by. And it was like three cop cars, you know, a couple, there were no Humvees or anything like that. It wasn't very military. It was just sort of a lot of cars, flashing lights, and then a van. Or not a van, excuse me. A bus, a big bus rolled by. That's for the President of the United States, the most powerful nation in the world, as he rolls through town, always under threat of assassination, always with people threatening his life. Can you imagine the number of death threats are received at the White House every day? Paul is the most wanted man in Jerusalem. You've got 250,000 to 1 million people that have been turned against him. 40 assassins want him dead and have said, we are not going to eat until he's dead. And so they lay him on a horse, probably down, surrounded by Romans, and they give him an armed escort out of town, the 60 miles up to Caesarea, so that he could stand in front of the governor. Here's this seeming peasant revolutionary that the Romans could not understand. And now, through these events, through this evil plot, they are inadvertently, unintentionally, and completely not what they wanted to do, putting Paul on the next step to his ultimate goal in his entire life of what God's created him to do, which was to stand before Caesar. He was going to stand before Rome. And because of their violence, because of this murderous plot, he not only gets closer to Rome, he gets there under the most heavy armed caravan ever. It's amazing that what man meant for evil in this moment, God is going to mean it for good. So Claudius Lysias writes a letter to Felix to prepare him for this particular special prisoner. Verse 26, Claudius Lysias to His Excellency, the governor Felix, greetings. This man, Paul, was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them when I came upon them with the soldiers and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman citizen. Now listen to this letter and see if he maybe tweaked the facts just a little bit, left out some details like he was ready to whip him and all this other stuff. Verse 28, and desiring to know the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council. I found that he was being accused about questions of their law, but charged with nothing deserving of death or imprisonment. And when it was disclosed to me that there would be a plot against this man, I sent him to you at once, ordering his accusers also to state before you what they have against him. So the soldiers, according to their instructions, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. And on the next day they returned to the barracks, letting the horsemen go on with him. When they had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they presented Paul also before him. On reading the letter, he asked what province he was from. And when he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will give you a hearing when your accusers arrive. And he commanded him to be guarded in Herod's praetorium. I love that right there. Isn't that great? You wait through a line, you do all this stuff to get to the right window at the Department of Motor Vehicles, and you finally get up there, and they're like, oh, you're in the wrong line. You need to go over to that window. Like, but they're now serving 19, and the number I took is 87. Please have mercy on me. He tried this. Felix is like, wait, where are you from? Cilicia. Oh, all right, fine. Yeah, you're in the right place. All right. When your accusers arrive, we'll schedule a hearing. See ya. He was trying to say, oh, you know what? Actually, you're not at the right place. You need to go. You need to go down the street to this other governor. He will handle your case. It's just amazing how he wanted nothing to do with this. You'll hear more about Felix next week and Drusilla, but just a little bit about him. He's an interesting story, but he was born a slave and sort of worked his way through. He married three times. Every time he married a more royal bride than before, always connected, sort of marrying his way into power. But he was especially hated and bloodthirsty. A Roman historian said that he was known for being given over to every sort of perversion and every sort of cruelty. He was known as being anti-Semitic. And it said that he had the power of a king, but he had the instincts of a slave. So in other words, he had all this power, but he just used it horribly. He had no idea what he was doing. So this is the man that Paul is about to stand in front of and plead his case to. But it's the next step to getting to Caesar. As we look at this story, I can't help but think, when you look back at your life and you see those moments where people wanted to harm you or people did harm you, and you look back and you say, what they may have meant for evil, God meant for good. That situation that I went through that was so difficult, that was so heartbreaking, that almost killed me, if that hadn't happened, I wouldn't have had this happen, which led me here. Have you ever looked at your life in that kind of a story and realized that sometimes the worst tragedy in your life God used to bring about the greatest victory in your life? That's just the way it seems to work. It's not easy. And when we're in the middle of the storm, we hold on to Jesus. When we're in the middle of the pain, he comes to us and says, take courage, hang in there. It's about to get worse, but I'm with you. You aren't alone. I'm going to use this for good. When Joseph was sitting alone in his jail cell, how many times do you think he wondered, what did that dream even mean? No one's going to bow down to me. Okay, I guess technically the other prisoners are under my command. Okay, I guess in Potiphar's house, I was the chief slave. You know, like he's thinking through, what does all this mean? And then at the end, and then later as the story goes on, Joseph is in charge of all of the kingdom, just second in command to Pharaoh. And people are coming to him to ask for food and buy it from him from all over the world because there is a famine. And lo and behold, here come the brothers. Here they come walking in. And they don't recognize him at all. Why? Because the Egyptians, he would have been clean shaven. No hair on his head, no hair on his face, linen robes, different type of eye. Sometimes they wore eye makeup and rings and jewelry. I mean, plus they're not looking for their slave slash dead brother to be the guy that they have to see. So the brothers walk in and they're just bowing down before him. Can you imagine being Joseph and standing up on your royal perch and you see them coming? The moment you've been waiting for decades, and here they come. The last time you saw them, you saw their faces standing over you, punching, hitting, kicking, and then throwing you into a slave caravan, laughing as you were taken off. And now here they come to grovel at your feet, the actual dream coming true literally right in front of you. What would you do? He had the power to say the word and they would be carted off to prison. Say the word, they could be executed. Say the word and anything could happen to them. Anything. No one would question it. He had all the power in the kingdom. And yet what does he do? He loves them. It says first he walked away and he wept. He was so overcome. I mean, that's why I love Joseph. It's like, it's not some guy that's like, well, look who's here. Or like, well, this is the moment that we've been waiting for. I must forgive you. Like, it wasn't some robotic response. Here he was. He saw him and he felt it. He had to walk out because he lost control of his emotion. He was weeping. He lost. He's like, they're here. What do I do? What do I say? How do I handle this? And he forgives them. And he gives them everything they need. He sees his father. And when his father dies, his brothers are still scared at the end of his life. He said, well, what's going to happen to us now? Dad's dead. Now he's going to get back at us. Isn't it amazing how they never, it's like they just live such a life where they didn't trust anyone. They were so insecure always of any relationship that they're like, okay, well, now that dad's dead, Joseph's going to get back at us now. Now he's going to wipe us out. Because before he probably felt like obligated to dad to keep us alive. And he says, no, you have nothing to worry about. And that's where he said the famous line, what you have meant for evil in my life, God meant for good, the saving of many lives. What incredible perspective that Joseph had. Jesus, as he's being nailed to the cross, says, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. They have no idea that this evil that they're placing on me is achieving for us a glory and a good that no one can imagine right now. And Paul Take courage, Paul. You're going to get to Rome. It's going to happen. And this murderous plot that was to snuff him out, unintentionally, the powers of darkness once again helped the gospel get further. Remember when the girl that was demon-possessed was like, here's Paul, listen to this guy, listen to him. And that advanced the gospel. And when the sons of Sceva get beat up by a demon and it led to a revival among the magicians in Ephesus, once again, the powers of darkness that thought they would overwhelm and overpower and show everyone who was boss, people understood that the name of Jesus was the most powerful name in the universe. So every time in the book of Acts that the enemy tries to snuff something out, it grows stronger. After Stephen was killed and Saul was there to watch it, what does it say? It says the church scattered, spread out, and ran to the ends of the earth. And as they left, they evangelized. They shared the gospel in Judea, Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. Every time the enemy tried to stomp out Christianity, the gospel of Jesus, it just spread faster and further. If we look at our lives and say, wow, every time the enemy tried to stomp something out of me, every time I was broken, every time I thought all hope was lost, every time I thought I couldn't take something else, God can take your pain and show you later what the purpose was. Because he doesn't waste any pain in your life. He uses it for good. I think of the verse, and our band's going to come up here and play a final song for us. I think of the verse that under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, Jeremiah wrote to the exiles who were in captivity, who would have been absolutely discouraged. They were in slavery. They were dragged away from their homes. They were conquered people. And you know what God said to them in their lowest moments to encourage them? He said, "For I know the plans I have for you, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans that give you a hope and a future." Can you imagine hearing that in a jail cell? Can you imagine hearing that in slavery? Be like, wait a minute, prosper and not harm me. I'm being harmed right now. I've been harmed. What does that mean? It means that in God's perspective, from God's understanding, he knows that what may hurt tonight is going to be gone in the morning. There's pain in the night, but joy comes in the morning. This is temporary. This is for a season. Though outwardly we're wasting away, inwardly we're being renewed day by day, for this light and momentary trouble is achieving for us a glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what we can see, not on what the struggles we have, but what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, what is unseen is eternal. So my prayer for you today, as we look at the story of Paul and keep going through the book of Acts, he was broken, he was bloodied, he was bruised, and now he was marked for a murderous end to his life, and yet God used that to send him exactly where he wanted him to be, because his purpose for his life was not going to be stopped. God uses our pain to achieve his purpose. What man has meant for evil, God meant for good, the saving of many lives. Will you pray with me? God, we love you so much. I thank you for this truth today. I pray that even as we look back at our lives and think of some of the hardest moments, and see how you've redeemed them, see how you've used them, see how you've crafted us through that crucible of pain. And you've formed us and you've shaped us through the fire. God, I pray that even now you would be close to the brokenhearted and you would save those who are crushed in spirit. And if someone who is here today is struggling with something in their life or there is something like this happening, I pray, God, that you would encourage them through your spirit to take courage and keep going, that you've got a purpose and a plan for their lives that's far bigger than any trial or temptation or evil that's been brought against them. We love you so much, God. I thank you for this story. I thank you for just what you're doing in this church and in this area. We're so excited to be a part of it. I pray that you would hear our worship to you now as we sing out with one heart. In Jesus' name, amen.